My name is Dick Hilden, and the title of this session is Perspectives on Central America. And I would underline the word perspectives. I would like to talk about two main points or major points relative to perspectives, particularly within the context of Central America. But a key word here is perspectives. And one of the points that I would like to make is the following. That is that our perspectives relative to the poor of the world is influenced by the extent to which we can step into the context of the poor. And I'll get into that a little bit more later. But that's one of the points that I want to deal with tonight within the Central American context. The second major point that I'd like to get into tonight is that there are perspectives relative to Central America that are in tension. On one hand, the perspectives of the haves or the affluent of the world over and against the poor and oppressed, particularly again in the context of Central America or Latin America, but more specifically Central America. So those two main things I'd like to talk about. But before I do, I'd like to say a word or two about myself to give you some basis for what I'm saying and to give you a basis for making some critical analysis of what I'm saying. Professionally, I'm an electrical engineer. I have been in corporate management for a number of years. I presently have an engineering company in Minneapolis at the time being. It's a company dealing with computer systems. So professionally, I'm an engineer. I do not have academic credentials relative to Central America, but rather I'm here to simply to share some experiences that I have had there and that I have had being in contact with a number of people who have spent time there. I also am the chairperson of the Center for Global Service and Education, which is affiliated with Augsburg College, and which has as one of its prime roles the raising of awareness of persons with regard to poor and oppressed in third world countries, and particularly in Central America and Latin America. One of the ways that we have done this is to sponsor trips, study trips and seminars to Central America, wherein people are able to, at least to a certain extent, find themselves within the context of the poor and oppressed in those places, and thereby get inputs relative to poverty and justice issues. So one of the major things that the center does is to sponsor such trips to Latin America. The center, incidentally, does publish a newsletter. I have some copies of it here. It is a means whereby we can hear more about the situation in Central America. If you'd like to look at that, in fact, if you'd like to take a copy of that with you, you may. I also have some brochures on the offerings of the center, which deal with some of the travel seminars and some of the other conferences and other offerings of the center, which you may like to look at. Some of these are current, some are not, and I would ask that if you do look at those, that you would leave them. Also, if you would like to be on the mailing list of the center, I have a sheet here, and I would simply ask you to sign your name, and you then would receive the newsletter and other items relating to third world countries with primary emphasis on Latin America. So that pretty much takes care of that little chore, and I'll move on a bit. My wife and I and my daughter Amy did go on one of our center's trips last year to Mexico and Nicaragua in August and into the first part of September. And it is on that basis, as I mentioned before, that I will be speaking, as well as my contacts with a large number of people that are there that have made trips to Central America, particularly Nicaragua and Honduras and El Salvador. I'd like to review just for a moment or two what else I'll be talking about this week, so that in the event that you do have a chance to be here and would opt to hear more about this issue and the Central American situation. Tomorrow at 7 o'clock in the Village Center, I will be doing a session called Voices Within Mexico. It is a 35-millimeter presentation of various people that we had a chance to have dialogue with in Mexico. And to the extent possible, I will be essentially the bearer of the messages that they gave to us. We have found that one of the best ways to be able to share in that kind of experience is to actually hear the words of the people that are, in many cases, in the midst of the struggling and the poverty in Mexico, and in other cases are simply a part of the structures within those countries. So tomorrow night, it will be Voices Within Mexico. Thursday at 4 o'clock, I will do a similar session, Voices Within Nicaragua. Then on Friday at 4 o'clock here, I will do a session, Mexico and Nicaragua, a case study of oppression, in which case we will go over some more detailed background of the history of those countries and some background to perhaps help us with some of the causes of the turbulent situation that we see there now, some of the revolution that we're sensing there, and some of the just rather stark turbulence that we see in those countries. Then on Saturday night at 7 o'clock, again in this room, we will do a session on faith responses to the situation in Central America. And at that time, I would hope to offer you some of my ideas, and I would also hope to hear and just gather ideas about what our response as Christians and as human beings, might be to that situation in Central America. So, now to proceed a bit. I want to talk just for a moment about this session format. I would like to speak maybe for 20 or 30 minutes, some of which I'm using up already, and then I would like to, and during that time, if you have questions of clarification, please just interrupt me. Feel free to do that during that time. Then at the end of the presentation time, I would like to open the session up to questions that you may have. And at that point, I would say that all questions are fair game. There are no questions that are inappropriate. A statement that I hear over and over and over again, and one that reflects my situation is, and maybe you have said this or maybe you've heard it, I don't know what to believe about Central America. I have heard conflicting information with regard to what is happening in Central America. The reality of that is that you have been hearing conflicting information. I think there is conflicting information that is being issued. Not maliciously. I think more it is more of with regard to the type of perspectives that are had on the issues taking place in Central America. So I have a request, and that is that you ask questions and raise comments during the discussion session. The second request I have is that on this issue, and as well as all issues, I think it appropriate to stay open-minded and critically analyze what you hear, both from me or anyone else that you hear on this issue, but also from the press and from other sources. There are few countries on this planet where we have such freedom to deal critically with issues. And I think it is so crucial that we do it. I see it not only as a privilege that we have in the United States, but I see it as a rather dire responsibility that we have to deal critically with these issues. It's the only way they will. Their rather complex natures will be dealt with appropriately, I believe. I would like to go over just a brief overview of Central America, giving you a feel for the geography, and perhaps just a kind of a snapshot statement about each of the countries with regard to its situation. You know, we hear these in the news constantly, the Central American countries these days, and it's fuzzy. It has been for me, and perhaps it has been for you, as to where they are and what is happening to them as a general whole. So I'm going to go to this map. I offer an apology to you for this map. I had intended to bring a map with me. In fact, I have it in my office. I forgot it, so I have drawn this one rather quickly, and I apologize for its not being as precise as it might be. But just to give you a brief rundown now of the countries, we of course know the United States is to the north, Mexico just south of that. The bordering on Mexico is Guatemala. The situation in Guatemala is such that there is a revolutionary process taking place there. The United States foreign policy in Guatemala is to attempt to support the government in putting down the revolution that is taking place in Guatemala. Guerrilla groups are operating there. They are fairly well organized. They're somewhat factional. But there is turmoil there. Belize is a very small country, which I know very little about. In fact, I probably didn't pronounce it correctly. I'm not terribly familiar with that. It has quite a small population of, I understand, perhaps 15,000. Then bordering on Guatemala is El Salvador, which we hear a great deal of these days. It's a relatively small country. It has 5 million people. It is the most densely populated of the Central American countries. It too has revolution and turmoil within it. There are guerrilla groups that are rebelling. The United States, as you know, has a foreign policy now of supporting the government to attempt to contain the revolution in that country. We have put an enormous amount of assistance dollars in El Salvador, as you know. We presently have a limit of something like 55 military advisors, as you may also know, in El Salvador. Honduras is a shaky democracy. We are using it essentially as the linchpin for our strategy in Central America. We are developing a base or two in Honduras from which we will operate activities and work on the El Salvadorian situation. We have troops presently in an exercise, something like 4,000 to 5,000 troops along the Honduran-Nicaraguan border. We have, as you are aware from the news, supported a covert operation of supporting counter-revolutionaries in Nicaragua bent on the overthrow of that country. The present government of Nicaragua. The counter-revolutionaries are made up principally of former Somozan National Guardsmen who were part of the Somozan regime prior to the 1979 revolution in Nicaragua. So we are militarily supporting the Contras here. It was covert up until about March or something like that, where it became public and quite overt, our intentions being to, at least verbally, to prevent the flow of arms into El Salvador. I'll speak about that a little bit later. Needless to say, I want to just say that there are American troops presently in what is called Big Pine 2, which is a military operation, a training exercise, very, very close to the Nicaraguan border. And it is clear that that is coupled together with the support of the counter-revolutionaries there. Nicaragua overthrew the Somozan regime, which was very dictatorial and very brutal in its rule for 43 years. That happened in 1979. It presently has its revolutionary government. The people in Nicaragua say that the fighting itself did not constitute the revolution, but that the process that they are in now constitutes the revolution in that country. That process being the building up of its society almost from ground zero. So they are in that process. I'll talk about that at some length at our Thursday session. Another word about our foreign policy. I'm not certain what the task forces are presently, but we have had on and off aircraft carrier task forces on both the Pacific and the Atlantic side. I think one of the carriers has gone to the Mideast, but I think the battleship New Jersey with its support group is on its way there. I'm not sure about that, but on and off we place major naval armaments on the two coasts of Nicaragua. So you can see that our military intimidation of that country is fairly solid. We want them to get a message. Costa Rica has been somewhat of a model democracy over the years, but at present there is turmoil taking place there. We have also attempted to enlist the support of counter-revolutionaries in Costa Rica to work on Nicaragua in the person of Aiden Pastora, who was a member who was involved in the revolution in Nicaragua and who has left that particular government. And Panama is, I'm not too familiar with that at this point, other than the fact that it has been used for training purposes by the United States for training Central American paramilitary forces.
Could you show us about where Cuba is?
Yes, Cuba is in the Caribbean, probably about here. Are there any other questions on this quick run-through of Central America?
Which one is most prosperous economically? Is it Costa Rica?
I don't know the answer to that question. I would suspect that Costa Rica has the most stable economy, although I'm not sure of that. I shouldn't render that that guess. I think one can say safely that all of the economies of these countries, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Nicaragua, are very shaky. And I can say with considerable certainty that the situation in Nicaragua, the economic situation is nearly disastrous at this point. At the time of the revolution in 1979, Somoza had incurred debts of something, foreign debts of something like $1.6 billion, had removed most of the money to banks outside of the country, and it left the government that then took over in the revolutionary process with a huge, huge foreign debt, with about $3 million in the treasury, which was enough for about 1 or 2 days for that country, and just a desperate situation. So they have started that economy on a very, very thin basis. So, and I'm quite certain that Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador also are suffering economically. We are, that is, the United States, I know, is cranking a lot of economic assistance into El Salvador. I think almost to the extent where we are supporting that country's economy, that we are the financial basis for that country at this point. But I'm not sure about Honduras and Guatemala.
Inflation,
I think, is quite high in those countries because of the amazing debt load that they have.
What are some of the products that are produced there that the United States depends on? The fruit, coffee, what is it?
It's fruit, coffee, sugar, cotton, bananas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cocoa
is one.
I read recently by a historian philosopher a statement to the extent that no country has ever profited for itself or about any help to another nation by involving itself in a civil war, the second nation. Do you have any opinion on that kind of a statement after your rundown on Central America?
Could I defer that question till the end of the presentation, and then would you raise it again for me? I will need some clarification in the question also, but I would be glad to speak to that from my perspective anyway, and perhaps be interested in hearing some others on that.
Where's Cuba then taking all those stuff to Honduras? They're saying the boats, you know, are coming from Cuba. Are they going to Honduras?
Which boats are you referring to now?
Well, ammunition, you know, they're like saying that
Cuba. Our allegations are that Cuba has been funneling arms into Nicaragua, which then they somehow or other get it to El Salvador. And it's not clear now how they get it there. It is clear that we have not been able to identify any proof that weapons are making that trip now to El Salvador. We have no solid proof of it. In fact, the ambassador in Nicaragua has said essentially that the flow of arms through Nicaragua to El Salvador has dried up, and that that should not be an issue.
And what's Panama doing? Are they neutral now or what?
I don't know. You know, I don't know the situation with Panama. I presume since we have given up the canal rights that they're a little bit feisty, but I don't know the answer to that question. And I think that Panama does not come strongly into play in this turmoil situation, except to the extent that the United States does use it for training military of the nation, certainly the El Salvadorian, and has historically used it for training of, say, the Somozan National Guard's people. Okay, moving on then. I'd like to make a recommendation of a book that you might find interesting. It's entitled Cry of the People by Penny Lurnell. I think it is in the bookstore here at Holden. It's a, just a superb book describing the struggle for human rights in Latin America, particularly as it relates to the role of the church, which is primarily the Roman Catholic Church, in Latin America. I recommend it highly.
Did you write that on the board?
I certainly will. Now I'd like to get into some perspective issues. I had originally thought of titling this session A Case for the Need for Global Perspective. It's my opinion that we in the United States have quite narrow perspectives with regard to issues that are global. Probably because we're so homogeneous, probably because we're so well off across the board in this country. We generally, in my opinion anyway, do not develop very good global perspectives. I had also thought of an alternate title, Or Things May Not Be What They Seem as Viewed from the Top of the Hilton or from the Gray Line Bus. My family and I have been on pleasure trips to Latin America, primarily for scuba diving purposes, in the Caribbean. In contrast to these pleasure trips, Joan, my wife, and Amy and I went to Mexico and Nicaragua, as I mentioned last summer, for the specific purpose of studying hunger, poverty, and justice issues there. It involved very, very intense sessions, morning, noon, and night, meeting with people. In Mexico, it was primarily those that you would identify as the poor and oppressed and the hungry and poverty-stricken. In Nicaragua, we made an attempt to get all perspectives, including the oppressed of that country, but also those who might be considered the oppressors. Maybe shouldn't make that judgmental statement. We tried to get as many perspectives as we could in that country. The difference in perspectives between our pleasure trips in Latin America and that trip that we had last year was stark. Throughout the diving trips that we've taken over the years, we felt no insecurity whatsoever. In spite of the fact that, and I guess we knew that, that the poverty was just over the fence or just behind that signpost. We were so close but felt we did not feel it. In contrast to that in Nicaragua, for example, we stayed in a very Spartan facility. In the middle of the night, I remember, we heard whistles and some footsteps, and I was certain, you know how you get kind of frightened in the dark? The dark tends to do that to you. I was certain at any moment that someone was going to pound on the door and there would be someone with a machine gun and who knows what would happen. Now that's, I think one's imagination carries one away in the middle of the night, of course. But one thing I wanted to say about that was that I didn't feel the insecurity from the standpoint of the Nicaraguan military, in spite of the fact that there is a military presence in Nicaragua. They are on a war footing right now. They have a state of emergency, primarily because of all this armament that's surrounding them. But I was worried at that point in time that a Somozan National Guardsman, a former one who was fed, trained, and armed by the United States government was going to appear at that door. And I tell you, it was just an incredible sensation for me, a very unique one. I've been a member of the armed forces of the United States, have always felt in a situation of control. But to find myself now in a situation where I was potentially threatened, by a country that was trained and armed by my own country was a very unique feeling for me. But it isn't unique for the people in Nicaragua. They live under that continuously. They are fearful that the United States-supported counter-revolutionaries from the north will invade that country. Very fearful of it. And the signs that we give them, I think, would support that fear. Needless to say, or I should say, that my perspective in those moments was severely altered. We have found in the centers, as we've talked to people who have returned from the study trips that the center has sponsored, that people who have traveled on these trips have come back to a great extent changed persons. The center has asked the question, why is this the case? And we've come to the conclusion rather solidly that one of the reasons that sensitivities are so strongly developed with regard to these issues is that the people on these trips are placed within the context of the poor and suffering. We also have at the center a task force for dealing, it's called the Business Task Force, and its role is to attempt to raise sensitivities of corporate officers that are doing business primarily in Central America, so that when they do business there, their sensitivities to what some of our business practices might be, so those sensitivities might be increased. And we, yes?
These companies do business down there, they set up a dynasty that kind of oppressed the people down there too?
There is a strong tendency for that to happen, yes. Generally, it's not a highly intentional, but it turns out to be a somewhat unintentional complicity between generally multinational corporations and the elite well-to-do in the Central American countries. Not highly intentional. I have sat in that corporate position. I simply don't recall the intentionality of doing that, and yet it does happen. There is a complicity there. Tomorrow night I'm going to talk about that, particularly as it comes into play in Mexico, where that phenomenon is perhaps the greatest. And I'll talk in details about some how that takes place. Generally, in the Central American countries, the economic interests of the United States are not too great. I think our trade with the group of countries that I've described here is something like $1.5 billion a year, which is not terribly great for the United States. So economic interests are not the overriding influence, I think, in Central America, in these areas. Although Guatemala, apparently, we have quite a bit of financial interest there, but certainly relatively little in Nicaragua. I suggest to you that most of us North Americans are so far from being within the context of the poor as to make our understanding of the plight of our poor and oppressed brothers and sisters almost non-existent. That's a strong statement, but I offer it again. I suggest to you that most of us North Americans are so far from being within the context of the poor as to make our understanding of the plight of our poor and oppressed brothers and sisters in Latin America almost non-existent, and for that matter, the poor in the United States. We are a society, that is, a good deal of us within this society are highly isolated from some of the poverty and oppression that takes place in our country, let alone the third world.
Yeah. Our TV station said the other day that 40 million people are hungry in this country.
In this country? Now, that's an incredible number. The numbers are very, very stark in Central America. That's a staggering number for the United States. I have about 5 slides here that show nothing but words, but I want to put them up on the screen so that the first one is a quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It was made to his co-conspirators during the Second World War. You may recall he was killed by the Nazis. There was a conspiracy against the Third Reich. He was involved in it. And he made a statement in writing to his co-conspirators that relates to this issue of the perspective that we have as we do or do not become with, into the context of the poor. Could you snap that projector on for me, please? Now, if you can't see this, don't worry. I'm going to read it word for word. I simply did not have it in my notes, and so I thought I may as well go with the projector. It remains an experience of inestimable value that for once we have learned to see the great events of world history from below. And bear in mind, he is writing this from prison at this point. He has been identified as one of the conspirators. From the perspective of the excluded, the suspected, the ill-treated, the powerless, the oppressed and despised, in short, the suffering. He found himself in the situation of being in the oppressed position and identified that as a very strong factor with regard to his perspective. He has, there's a conclusion to this, which I'd like to show you at the end, which makes a statement also, but I would like to continue at this point. I believe that there's a consensus among people that have been involved with Central America and Latin America, more generally, that there exist differing perspectives relative to the situation in Central America. On one hand, there is the perspective of the more affluent, primarily in North America, but I would put in that category also the elite and powerful in Latin America. Over and against that perspective that we find of the poor and oppressed in those countries. And there are two aspects of it that I'd like to talk about. I think it's very important or very germane to the issues in Central America. One has to do with the theological perspectives, and the second has to do with the political perspectives. I have a slide here that I think will help to it's a model of that enhances theological discussion. We could spend 5 hours on it. I don't want to do that. I simply want to use this to convey to you what is happening in with regard to the theological perspectives in Central America. If we look at this top row, which shows Jesus Christ looking at the cross and the benefactors of Jesus looking from the other direction, it suggests, and I don't want to go into this in too much detail, that the benefactors, that is us generally, all peoples that benefit from that act, tend to see the cross somewhat intellectually and fail to see it as part of a suffering which we must go through. We tend to intellectualize the cross. As a high generalization, I apologize for that, but I just want to get into this mode of thinking here. Last night at our Eucharist Vespers, for those that were here, I think the sermon that Manfred preached was very directly addressed to that particular issue, is that we don't want to see the suffering involved with that cross. We tend to have a different perspective. Moving down this graphic, we see that our perspective relative to the gospel is also has two facets to it. The well-fed affluent, that is generally us, and many within Latin America itself, view the gospel again as something somewhat intellectual, something to be affirmed, something to be told. The hungry, poor, and oppressed today in Latin America see the gospel as something more than that, and that's a point that I would like to make. Prior to about 1960, the Roman Catholic Church, throughout the history of Central America, had essentially this perspective. And that perspective was essentially that there is the kingdom of God on earth and that kingdom of God in heaven. You will have everlasting life in heaven, but on earth you must be satisfied with your lot. That was the perspective that the Catholic Church has promulgated in throughout the history of Central America until early 1960. And it certainly is, to an extent, the perspective we have. Something has taken place in Latin America. And it happened and was, I think, instigated at the time of Vatican II, the Second Vatican Council, in the early 1960s. That was followed by a Latin American Bishops Conference in Medellin, Colombia, in 1968. And the outcome of that conference was documents which made the statement that that people in Latin America, those oppressed, were created in the image of God and as such had a right to dignity and to a reasonable human life. The documents that came out of that conference laid that basis. And what happened was that a number of base Christian communities have spread up throughout Latin America, which do a couple of things. One is they conduct Bible study, their small group sessions. But another thing they do is to deal with some of the oppressive things that are taking place with regard to God's people there. And it is resulting in people in Latin America seeing that they do have a right to more dignity than they have had throughout their history. What has that has been encompassed within a theology called liberation theology. That theology tends to not look at the dual aspect of the of God's kingdom on earth and God's kingdom in heaven, but rather encompasses that into a unifying kingdom and thereby makes more important for a theological viewpoint the care of persons, physical care of persons. So that has taken place, and it's a very strong influence in Central America and needs to be recognized. And then our faith tasks, that is our faith responses as a result of those things, of this taking place, have changed. We see our faith tasks more or less to proclaim the gospel with less emphasis on caring for those social justice issues. Our Latin American brothers and sisters see their faith tasks more related to resolving of some of these social justice items. So that those two theological perspectives now exist in somewhat in tension. There are conflicts within the Roman Catholic Church in Latin America today over this very issue. And to a certain extent, the church in Latin America has found itself somewhat polarized around this issue. The next thing I'd like to do is talk about the political perspectives that are in tension between the North American affluent and those wealthy Latin Americans and the poor. And it's best shown in these two statements. And I believe there's legitimacy to both of these. The first one is made by Jean Kirkpatrick, who is the United States Ambassador to the United Nations. And I think it somewhat summarizes the political perspective that that we hold, particularly in the United States. And it reads, there is a plan to create a communist Central America, which, if successful, will have momentous consequences for our security and that of our European allies, and for the unfortunate people of Central America. The other statement, I think, encompasses the other political perspective that we find among the poor and oppressed in Central America. It is made by Aldo Diaz, who is a member of the Nicaraguan Foreign Ministry. It says, the problems in Latin America are not due to the East-West struggle, but to archaic structures that make effective social justice impossible. Here on the one side, on the one that is forming most of the basis for American foreign policy, we see that the problem is an East-West struggle, that is, between the non-communistic and the communistic countries of the world, the East and West blocs. The perspective that we find in Aldo Diaz's statement is one that says that the struggle is not that East-West struggle so much, but is rather due to structures within the countries that simply make the cure of injustices very tough to do. So here again we have these two perspectives, political perspectives in tension. And again, I would say there is a tendency on the part of most of us to choose one or the other and to migrate all the way to the wall on one of them, when in reality it would seem that there is legitimacy in both of those and that they would both need to be taken into account. Before I proceed, I'd like to open now at this point to some questions. Do you have any questions with regard to
this.
I have another question. It relates to, right to what you're saying here. In Germany this summer, I picked up a German newspaper and was reading the Latin American articles. And one of them came out quite strong, saying, the United States simply cannot understand Latin America because it doesn't understand the political spectrum. The United States would either see things as right or wrong. It's either far left or far right. And in Central America, the big problem is the centrist position. And the extreme right and the extreme left are fighting, and the people in the center are the victims. And that it is not, and we're saying the same thing that Aldo Diaz is saying. Mm-hmm. And that, but our inability to understand it is that we have a government of two political parties. It's either one or the other, and we don't understand the concept of a center politically.
That's an interesting observation, I think. I think that you raise an interesting point there. Most, I think, of the West European countries, and certainly the Eastern European countries, do not necessarily agree with our position, our foreign policy in Latin America and Central America. And certainly, those countries that would be considered to be neutral with regard to the situation in Central America are not in strong approval of what we're doing there. You may be familiar with the Contadora group, which is made up of four countries in Latin America, which have adopted some recommendations relative to the resolution of the situation. I think the point you make does reflect the attitude of many of our European allies. Other questions? Yes.
I mean, like, they're trading one tyrant for another. And which one is going to be the worst?
You say they're trading one tyrant for the other?
If they go communist. They'd be worse than they're off out in the air now.
Well, that's an argument that is often made. And there's no question about the fact that kind of consideration has to come into play. I think one finds that when we look at the situation with regard to these situations in these countries, that they are less aligned with East or West or even the communist ideology than we think they are. The Nicaraguan view that I have, and I think that is seen over and over again by people visiting that country, is that Nicaragua wants to be Nicaragua. It does not want to be aligned with the Soviet Union. It wants to have a pluralistic society. It wants to have a mixed economy that is part socialism, part capitalism, a private sector that is on an equivalent basis with the public sector. So we see in Nicaragua, I think, a very interesting third alternative, which I think needs to be looked at and possibly nurtured. And I'm not going to make a proposal as what I think we ought to do. But I do think we need to look at some alternatives, and I think Nicaragua is an interesting possibility there.
A month ago, before we came out here, I heard this famous Catholic theologian, Henry Nouwen, give a talk at Catholic University. He was standing proud in a small auditorium. He'd just come from his post in Lima, Peru, and stopped in Nicaragua for a month just to observe what's going on. And there were so many points that he made, but among those I just remember a few, and that's one of them in particular. It was that he walked the streets in the streets of Nicaragua and talking to the people. They said, for the first time, we feel like we have something to say about our government. For the first time. Now, that was one reaction he had. Another one that I remember is that he visited two Catholic churches. One of them, the substance of the sermon was, you love the church and the bishop. The other one was the other way before the people, and just like you said, the division between the Catholic Church. He described that situation, the problems there.
Yes.
It was the most interesting.
Interesting. He has spent now, is it Joan? How long has he been there in Central America?
He's been back and forth through. He's very familiar with what's going on because his present post apparently is Lima, Peru, and the Catholic post office. He's so well known in
his
writings and so on that he's recognized as, I wouldn't say authority, but it's certainly a voice.
A strong voice.
A strong voice that speaks for the oppressed when they're looking for justice.
Yes. He has written a book on his current stay in Central America called Gracias.
Yes, it's available in the bookstore about the 6 months in Bogota and then.
Dick?
Yes.
Was road credit cut off to the Chinese government?
Was world credit?
I thought I read somewhere that the U.S. was quite instrumental in cutting off world credit, which of course has made the task of this mixed bag government almost impossible.
Yes. The statement was, or the question was, has Nicaragua been cut off from world credit? And to the extent that the United States has been able to do that, it has been done. With its influence in the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund has been such that Nicaragua is hurting very much now for loans. I have in my notes, but it's back in my room, the percentages of credit and where they come from with regard to Western countries, other third world countries, and the socialist countries. It is high in Western countries and third world countries, relatively low in the socialist or the Eastern Bloc countries, but it's getting, I would say, and I'm not certain of this, but I think that it is increasing with the Soviets simply because they must have the money to build up their economy. What appears to be happening is that our policies with regard to Nicaragua is doing just what one would think we don't want to do, and that is forcing that country to rely more heavily on the Soviet Union and other Eastern Bloc countries. And they simply must. Their economy is just a disaster. They had very severe floods in 1982 that cost something like $350 million, the losses involved there. They just simply have to have assistance. And we aren't giving it to them now, and so they are having to go more and more toward the east for it. Same situation with regard to defensive weapons. They have found it necessary, in view of their position, that they are in a state of war, have had found it necessary to go to, as we know from reading in the papers, to sources of defense weapons primarily that we aren't too pleased about. The Soviet and other foreign countries that are not particularly friendly to the United States. Yes?
Why can't some of the so-called experts on Central America get together if they understand the fact that the USA would do better by supporting Nicaragua economically? They couldn't get together and say, look, we're going to drive them right into the Soviet bloc if the Sandinista government should fail. What other option do they have? We've supported the Somozans, and now we don't know what we're up to there. There's a feeling that the government has a policy that is not clear.
Well, I would speculate on that. It's clear that we have been groping around for trying to find someone that could set up an alternate government in Nicaragua. We did it with Eden Pastora in the south. We attempted to get Eden Pastora together with the counter-revolutionaries of the former Somoza National Guardsmen. We have groped around and looked for a possible alternative government to the present Sandinista government. Falling short of that, we simply haven't been able to do that. My speculation is, and this is speculative, is that our policy might say, let's force the Sandinista government toward a more totalitarian position such that their credibility will fade away. It is conceivable to me that we are doing that. I find it hard to account for our policy anything short of that. But again, it's speculative, and I offer it only as that.
To help me understand the problem down there, from what I understand the problem, about 2% of the people own about 98% of the wealth. And regardless of historically, regardless of what kind of government you get in there, that doesn't change. You still have a small elite group in control of the wealth of the country, and something is going to have to change in terms of redistribution of wealth down there that, I don't, years and years and years they've been changing governments down there, and nothing has changed.
Yes, you make a good point. Your statistic might be a little high, that 2% on 98% of the wealth in the countries, but certainly the statistics are staggering in that direction, that most of the property and wealth has been owned by a small elite that in fact has had dominance in those countries, and changes of government don't seem to make much difference. That's why I think the Nicaraguan thing is something that we should look at and consider as an alternative. Because what has happened in Nicaragua is that a dictatorial government of the sort that you described, the Somozan regime was certainly that, what you described, has been overthrown, albeit violently, but it has been overthrown, and in its place is a government that is attempting to build that country up almost from the grassroots. It is doing it with some exceedingly, what I think is progressive land reformation. It is doing it by mass education of its people. The illiteracy rate in Nicaragua, for example, since the revolution in 1979 has gone from about 50%, that is 50% of the people were illiterate in 1979 at the time of the revolution, to the point where it is only 12% now. We see a redistribution of the wealth in that country, although they're doing it on the basis that those private holders that own a good deal of land can keep it if they keep the land productive. It's a land reformation program that I think is a reasonable one, and one that has considerable hope for success. So I think I would be very excited about, and am very excited about, what is happening in Nicaragua.
We're going to have the same problem. We here, Mexico's going to have the same problem before too long with that all the rest of them are having there, because they've got the same situation.
Yeah, same situation in Mexico. In fact,
there's nothing that we can do about it.
There's nothing
in our country.
That's right. It seems to me, and I'll talk about this more on Thursday, but this man, Aldo Duarte, said, they have, since the day of the revolution, tried to approach the United States and asked for assistance and support in the Nicaraguan experiment, but haven't had much success, obviously. I lost my train of thought.
What's the percentage in the United States that have the law?
No. Well, certainly in the United States, the distribution of the wealth is considerably greater than it has been.
Because he said 2%.
Well, he said that in Central America, 2% own 90% of the wealth. That number is too high. I can give you some statistics. In Nicaragua, before the revolution, Somoza owned about 40% of the arable land, and that was the good arable land. He had started out without any money, essentially, when the Somozan family took over in 1933 and amassed 40% of the arable land. By the time he was overthrown, Somoza owned something like 30% of the major industry in Nicaragua, including the 26 largest companies. Imagine that. 26 of the largest companies in Nicaragua were owned by Somoza. The airline, a large brick manufacturer. You see Somozan produced bricks everywhere now. So that's the same point, that a very small percentage of the people own, in that case, a considerable amount. And that is fairly prevalent throughout Latin America, with some exceptions, but not many. And that's due to a great extent to historical and cultural reasons, and we'll be going into that a little bit more tomorrow and Thursday.
What's your opinion of this statement that I've heard? The poor people down there are representative of these ones that under
have said that don't help us. You can help us humanitarian, but don't send military. Don't help us at all. Let us solve our own problems. Why do we have to keep on interfering in other people's affairs?
It's a good point. In fact, that's where I lost my train of thought about what Aldo said. I appreciate your saying that. We ask them why there are so many Cubans in Nicaragua. There are something like 3,000 Cuban healthcare and medical, and even some, he didn't say how many, but some military advisors, but a relatively small number of military. We ask him, why are there Cubans here? And his immediate response was embarrassing to me. And he says, why aren't there Americans here? And the last thing I wanted to say was that Aldo said, we have asked for help from the United States. And he said, go back and tell your government and your people that if you can't help us, then for God's sake, leave us alone. And that statement has struck with me. I want to read a poem, and it gets back to this perspective issue. It was written by one of the persons that went on our trip to Nicaragua and to Latin America. And it talks something about not only their liberation, but perhaps some of ours. I'd like to read it for you. We are back now, the 23 of us, newly born again to life, to struggle and to pain we never knew before, led into life by those who live daily with death, fed by the hungry who took our white hands uncalloused into theirs, dry and gnarled and drawn and brown. They took us in, the strangers, into barren huts with shy smiles. They shared their sparse lives. Don't, we beg you, ask us if we had a good time. It was painful, stabbing. The ache will burn within us, haunting our safe American dreams, for they, the last of the earth, have found us, moved us to reality, that in the finding, perhaps, just perhaps, have saved us.